All right, today's shiur is on Megillat Eicha. I'm going to depart a little bit from my plan. I think the title of the lesson was meant to be exile or the destruction of Jerusalem in four stages. And I am going to get to that, but I felt as I was going through the material that I really needed to take a kind of a step back and sort of kind of take in the totality of the book, or at least the first two chapters and the last two chapters. We're not going to spend too much time on the middle chapter now, which is really sort of distinctive in and of itself, and sort of take a look at the book itself and just go through some basic ideas about the book and try to understand its structure. And hopefully after seeing the flow of the book, we could start to analyze the steps and the progress that happens during the course of Megillat Eicha. Probably I'll try to translate everything, but if you have a Tanakh available to you or a Megillat Eicha available to you, that is a good thing. Otherwise the text will be on the screen much of the time. Please feel free to kick in, and if what you see on the screen does not look right, does not look as you're expecting, so please just kick in and let me know, or as I go into the screen presentation mode, I probably won't see the chat bar, so please feel free to speak up, and I'll hear you over the microphones. And now I'm going to switch over to the sources, and we will begin. What you should be seeing is the first chapter of Eicha. You may have to scroll down a little bit to see the bottom text. And the first thing that will grab you is a very important idea of, I wanted to really discuss the idea of the Eicha as a poem, and as a beautiful poem, and as a very complex poem. Now, Shalom, are you reading me okay? Am I coming in all right?
That's fine. Go on.
Okay. So before we get to the acrostic, to the alphabetic form, I just want to show you some interesting things about the poem itself. You'll notice that there's the repeated use of words which have more than one meaning, which is an interesting idea. So in the first verse, we have Rabati, Ha'ir Rabati Am, and we have Rabati Bagoyim Sarati Bamdinot Haita Lamas. That's two different uses of the word Rabati. In the first case, it means a city of many, many people. It's talking about quantity. And in the second Rabati, Rabati Bagayim, that's talking about leadership, like a Rav in a qualitative sense. And this is something that you see in poetry quite a bit in ancient times, as well as medieval poetry. If you read Ibn Ezra, he's constantly playing with this idea. It was a challenge almost. I read a book called Wine, Women, and Death, a wonderful book on poetry of the Spanish period, the great Spanish period of El Andalus. And they were given words where they were challenged within 5 minutes to come up with a poem that would use that word in five or six different ways. Today we have things called smash rap poetry contests and whatnot, and Lahavdil Elef Alafim, between the two, but nonetheless, there's the idea that the poet really honed his trade very, very well. By the way, you have to be careful because Rabati Am does not mean my great, it's just Rabaam and Rababa Goyim. That T ending is a poetic form. Rashi points that out, Ibn Ezra points it out. It appears quite a bit in poetry, like Lesusati Berichve Faro Dimitech Rayati from Shir Shirim. And we have it in different forms where you have an E ending, such as in on Shabbat. We have a Mizmor on Shabbat where we say, Ale Asor, Ale Navel, Ale Higayom Chinor. And really it means Al, but we add the A to sort of give it that extra beat that the poet was looking for. So far so good. Any comments on what I'm speaking about yet? We good? I'm not getting any feedback. I just want to know if people can hear okay.
You're fine. If they can't, they tell us.
You say that people never tell you when things are going well?
they're coming in fine, and the diagrams are good.
Okay, very good. Now, if you notice, the most obvious thing that pops out at you about Eicha is the acrostic. That is, it starts with an Aleph, and then a Bet, and then a Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, all the way down to the letter Tav. And I included the Psukim numbers to show, first of all, it was easier to do so, but second of all, to show you that every letter of the alphabet is covered. It's sort of Tehillah David or Mimcha Elohei HaMelech. Now, this was something that's found in Jewish poetry. We have this in a few Tehillim. Of course, Kuf Yud Zayin is the famous one where we have Tamnia Alpha Beta, which is eight times the alphabet. There's a mizmor that we don't usually say responsibly because it would take all day. So the idea of an alphabetic acrostic is common. It really is not found in similar poetry of the time for two reasons. In Mesopotamia and in Egypt, it wasn't an option because they didn't have they had no alphabet. In Ugarit and other Phoenician dialects, there was an alphabetic, but as far as we know, it did not, not that it didn't exist, but we certainly haven't dug up any alphabetic work from Phoenicia where they did have an alphabet that which controlled their writings. But it goes a step farther than that, and a beautiful step farther than that. And I'm going to show you something, and I'll switch back just so I could see you all. But I want you to notice something. I'm going to play around a little bit with colors here. If you noticed, I highlighted the word Rabati Am and Hayatak Almana Rabati Ba Goyim. If you look at the last line in Chaf Bet, you may have to scroll down for this if it's not on your screen. You'll notice the word Ki Rabot An. Let me try that again. Ki Rabot An Chotai Bulibi Dava. Do you see that word Rabot? Tying together the first pasuk, Aleph, with the last pasuk. Now, if that's all I had, I wouldn't have much to go on. But I'm going to change the color now of my pen to, let's try red. And I'll notice the second pasuk has the word Ein La Menachem. I'm going to highlight it right now. Go to the bottom, Chaf Aleph, you'll see Ein Menachem Li. If we go to the third pasuk, I'm going to change the color now to, maybe a blue. I'm going to highlight the words Bein Hamitzarim. And then on the third to last pasuk, you'll notice the words Kitzar Li. I'm going to do a few more just to make sure that everybody believes me. I'll go to a different color now. Let's try some, magenta. And you'll see something that says, Kohanim ne'enachim, the priest were sighing. And on the fourth to last pasuk, you'll see, Kohanai uskenai be'ir gavau. On the fifth pasuk, and I'll stop with that because I don't want to bore anybody, I'll get a nice green. So there's a connection here also. Ayutzarel, the Rosh, Oyver, Shaluki, Adonai, Hogar, Rob, Shael, Loach, Ushvi, Lifnei Tsar. So we have, maybe somebody could kick in and tell me where the connection is, because I know it's there. Is it Halchu Shvi Lifnei Tsar? Let's see. Yep, there it is. Bachurai Halchu B'Shevi. So essentially what you have is something called Atbash, where every pasuk matches up to the last pasuk, and then the bet matches up to the shin, and the gimel matches up to the resh, etc., all the way down to the chaf and the lamed in the middle. And everyone has a connection between the two. And what that tells us is that this is a superbly crafted, well-thought-out piece of poetry. In fact, there's a person by the name of Segel who wrote on Tanakh, he was a scholar of Tanakh, and he wrote that it couldn't have been written during Yirmiyahu's time. Yirmiyahu could not have written the Sefer because it's so well crafted that it must have been written later when somebody had a time to relax and chill out and put together this type of craftsmanship. But I think that's Segel knows a lot about Tanakh, but I think he doesn't know a lot about poems and poetry. And poets know how to do their business. This is what they practice. This is what they do. So I doubt that Yirmiyahu wrote this while he was literally running out of the city. But this was something that he put together. It's a beautiful piece of work. And it's not limited to the first chapter. But let me switch back to the presentation just so I can get some some feedback from everybody. Okay. Everything okay? I'm looking at the bottom. All clear from Bella Hochberg on the bottom. Okay. Very good. Okay, so I'm going to switch back. I think my face is not nearly as impressive as Yirmiyahu's writings. So I'll switch back now to Yirmiyahu's writings and just take a look at the other Prakim. And this way we could say we really pretty much covered all of the book before we even get into the real business. So let me switch over. And what you should see now on your screen, or coming up on your screen shortly, is Perek Bet. I see it still says, I'm using a different computer, I still see Perek Aleph, but there's Perek Bet. So if you notice, the acrostic exists in Perek Bet as well. You have Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav, Zion, all the way to Tuf. I'm not going to go through the process, but you'll notice the At Bash there. For instance, in Aleph it says, Echa Ya'iv Be'apo, how he darkened things or how he clouded things with his anger. And in the last pasuk it says, V'lo haya b'yom af Hashem, in the anger of his time. And you'll find that in the pasuk bet it says, Bila Adonai v'lo chamal, and in pasuk chaf aleph, on the shin pasuk it says, Haragta b'yom apecha tavachta v'lo chamalta. And again, you could go through the whole chapter looking for this Atbash technique. So it's, again, highly crafted. Does anybody see anything different, though, with the acrostic? Does anybody notice a variation in the acrostic? I can't see your comments, so you have to speak up if you see anything. I'll wait a few seconds, and then I'll give it away myself.
Well, Pei and Samach are reversed.
The pay, a little more, you're close. Not the Pei and the Samach. Which two letters are reversed?
Okay. Ayin and Pei.
Ayin and Pei are reversed. That's correct. By the way, Shalom, I'm getting an error message on some services. I may click it away and disappear. If so, I'll bring up the window again in a second. So I apologize if I back out. Ayin and Pei are reversed. And, of course, in the first chapter, they are not reversed. The ayin and pei come in the order that we would expect. Here it's pei and ayin. You'll find that in chapter 3 it's also pei and ayin, and in chapter 4 it's also pei and ayin, which means the minority vote is the vote that we have. In Tehillim also, you have some Tehillim with ayin and pei and some with pei and ayin. Chazal gives an explanation for this. They say that if you notice, the pasuk says patsu alayich pihem kol oyvayich. They opened their mouths against you. They shouted out against you, all of your enemies. And Chazal say that they used their mouths before using their ayins of the next pasuk. They spoke before they looked to see what was going on. But that doesn't really work with the other prakim. I don't want to give too scientific of a reason. One thing I could say is that Yirmiyahu must have had something in mind, for sure. Because otherwise, all of the prakim would be pei and ayin, rather than the first one being ayin and pei. What he had it on his mind is always going to be a homily. We could go with what the rabbis say. We could also offer a slightly more scientific explanation, which is that it could be that in the early days, the alphabet wasn't solidified like it was during Mishnaic and Amoraic times. That is, in the first temple, or at the end of the first temple, it was still a question of whether Pei would go before Ayin, and Ayin would go before Pei. It's possible that there's significance here, it's possible that there's not, but it is certainly something to note. I'm going to go on to the next chapter, and I'm skipping chapter 3, because chapter 3 is an entity in and of itself, and I'll talk about that when we get there. Sean, can you still hear me? This error message that I have is not interfering?
No, not yet.
Okay. You'll notice an acrostic in Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Hey here as well that goes all the way to the bottom. Pei and Ayin are also switched. And finally, we'll go to the last chapter, which is Echa Perek Hey. And here we'll notice something very interesting. So I ask you a question. Is it an acrostic or not? Is it alphabetic or is it not alphabetic? What would you say? Anybody?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Does it look alphabetic? Or the last parak of Echa, Parakeh, I said that all the first four chapters are alphabetic. The third one we didn't look at. When we look at the last chapter, does it look alphabetic?
No.
So at first glance, it certainly does not. But take a look and count how many verses there are in the last chapter. Does everybody see how many there are?
Yeah, 22, like the alphabet.
So what is that? We're in speculation land. Yirmiyahu has used 22 psukim on all the chapters, except for the third one, which is 22 times 3. So he's used an alphabetic format, but in the last chapter, he is not used an acrostic. Now, we're in homiletic land. We can't know what Yirmiyahu's mind is, but what would you say would be the reason for dropping the alphabet? I'd also, before you answer the question, I would ask another question. Look at the length of the verses compared to the first chapters. I'll take you back for a second. Let's go back to first chapter 1. It'll take a second for the screen to refresh. There's chapter 1. Now we'll go to chapter 2. Now chapter 4.
They're about half as long in Parak.
Exactly right. So I have a speculation, but I don't want to force it down anybody's throat, and I assure you it's just a speculation. What sense do you get then when you look at chapter 5 with the length of the verses and with the fact that there are 22 psukim but there's no alphabet? What sense may Yirmiyahu, the perfect poet, which is what I was trying to demonstrate before, what is the master poet trying to convey with the use of the very letters that he wrote with?
Well, the book is a lament, so maybe it conveys the feeling of crying and chaos.
And when does that chaos really come to its sea, to its apex?
At the end.
It's like everything, I agree, it's like everything has fallen apart. It's like he has no strength to put together long verses. He has no strength to put together an alphabet. It's as if total chaos has descended. We have a chaos that not only descends on the poem, but through the poem, I get the sense that we have a chaos that slowly but surely descends on Yerushalayim and the Jewish people as a whole. Now, again, that's my view. And any time a poet does something, you'd always say, well, he didn't do it for that reason, he did it for a different reason. But that's the sense I get. Chaos and shortness and almost a silence descending on the poem. And I would like to note the last pasuk here. So now we could say we did the beginning of the book and the end of the book, so we covered the whole book. We read at the end, Hashiveinu Adonai Elecha v'nashuva chadesh ha'meiv k'kedem. Then we read the last pasuk, because the last pasuk is kind of a bummer. We go back to Hashiveinu when we read on Tisha B'Av. But if you take a look at the last pasuk, there's anger there. Most of the other ends of the prakim have been anger at the enemies who have been coming against us. But look who the anger is here at the very end of the book. Ki'im ma'os me'astanu. Because even if you have found us to be disgusting, kafatzta aleinu ad ma'od, katzafta aleinu ad ma'od, you have become too angry with us. Your anger is simply too strong. And who is that directed against? Who is that anger directed? Who is the anger of the poet? The poet directed against? I think Hashem is absolutely correct. I'm going to switch back into speak mode just so I can see what everybody is doing for a second. I think, who said Hashem? Was that Yael or somebody else? Well, whoever it was.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Very good. I think that you've got it. That is, at the end, there's such a frustration that there's a call of anger against God. And what's interesting here in the book, and this is really not something that we're going to go into in depth, the book does not take an Eov stance or a Kohelet stance to God. This is not an act, a book of theodicy where he's trying to justify God. We may not see it today, but if you do readings yourself, you'll see. We sinned. Our father sinned, and we're sinning. I'm sorry, Bella, what did you say? Bella, did you say something? Okay. The book takes an approach that we, Jerusalem, has sinned, that the prophets, Nivu Masaot Maduchim, they did not come through with the truth, and because of that, God punished us as he deserved to do. And yet, the destruction is so total, and the horror so real, which is what we're going to take a look at soon, that the sense of frustration simply bubbles out. The author, the poet, is unable to put together his poetry. He's unable to speak his mind. And ultimately, in a last act of desperation, he really calls out to God and says, it's not fair. With that in mind, we'll go back to the text, and I want to take a look at a slightly closer analysis of the text. Does anybody have any questions up to this point? Would anybody like to jot them in? You could type them in, or you could speak them.
I have a question about something you said earlier, that maybe the alphabet wasn't quite formulated yet, and I'm wondering if that's the case, what happens to gematria, which is supposed to have very deep meanings and so forth, and gematria proceeds in its numerical value along the order of the letters that we understand them to be today.
It's a terrific question, and the answer, there are two answers, one which would support gematria and one which would wind up refuting some of the basis for gematria. Of course, a refutation of gematria was taken up by the Ibn Ezra, who didn't like the whole thing, even though admittedly we take gematria to sort of an ad absurdum today. Sometimes it's unplayful. I remember being in Elizabeth and Rabbi Teitz, he could put together any gematria you could hope for, and it's fun. It's interesting to watch. The gemara, though, sometimes uses it for very real darshanut, although rarely, but it does. So it's possible that ayin pei was the correct quote-unquote format, and that pei and ayin is being used to express something that we no longer know what that expression is. The second possibility, Yisrael, is that gematria is artificial, that its meaning may be much like a midrash, that it's there to convey a message. I would have to say that if you're a big fan of Sefer Yetzirah and Sefer Bahir, which the Ramban, Nachmanides, was, you would have a very difficult time saying what I said, which is that once upon a time the alphabet was not necessarily ordered as we have it. So what I'm saying, my approach that the alphabet may not be have that solidified order, is definitely not compatible with a gematria-centered view of the Hebrew language. Okay. And if there are no other questions, I'm going to go back to the text itself. Again, it looks a lot prettier than I do. So I also have to come up with a better joke now. Show my desktop and select an application. And I'm going to bring up the PowerPoint. Okay. And now you should see a slightly a smaller version. Oh, very interesting. Is the text being blocked by an error message? Does anybody see that?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so I'm going to try to fix that in a second. Okay, I'm going to try to fix that. Just a second. Bear with me. Okay. There we go. Now we're back to Eicha chapter 1, and I'd like to do a slightly closer analysis of the text itself. I know the text is slightly smaller, but hopefully you'll be able to see what it is. Otherwise, the Tanakh may be helpful. The first powerful metaphor that we have is the fact that the person who is suffering here, at least in chapter 1 and 2, we'll see it sort of goes through the book to a certain extent, is that Tzion, Yerushalayim, as a representative not only of the Jewish people, but as the city itself, is being compared to a woman. She was like a widow. So I would like to say it's almost a simile where, you know, my eyes were like round plates. There's some very bad poetry. But it's more than that. There's really a metaphor going there. Echa yashva badad ha'ira bat yam, and then we'll see that some of this is not a simile at all. Some of this we're very much immersed in the metaphor. We have a woman in front of us who is suffering to a very great extent. The concept of a woman suffering, or Yerushalayim, more specifically of Yerushalayim being represented by a woman, is very common in Tanakh, and it appears very often in Yeshayahu, in chapters of Yeshayahu, both in the famous Nechama sections of chapter 40 and on, as well as earlier sections as well. And it's important to notice something about biblical metaphor. It takes a second to speak about biblical metaphor. Some metaphor I would call deep metaphor, where you are so immersed in the imagery, you really can't tell necessarily what it's referring to. The most famous case of that is Shir HaShirim, where we are so immersed in the metaphor of the lover and her beloved, or his beloved, that there's no way to really tell by itself, well, I shouldn't say no way, but it's very difficult to see what the metaphor is representing, and therefore many people interpret Shir HaShirim as a love story. There's a very light metaphor, which is close to simile, where we're saying, oh, it's like something. For instance, she was like a widow. But in front of us, we don't really have an image of a widow yet. Our image is really of Yerushalayim with nobody around her. And then, of course, it continues. Rabati bagoyim, sarati bamdinot, hayita lamas. Probably not talking about a woman. It's probably talking about Yerushalayim. But in the second verse, we go much deeper. She surely cries at night. V'dimata alechaya, and the tears are on her cheeks. Ein la menachem mikolo avea. None of her lovers give her any comfort. Kol re'eho bagduva. All of her friends or patrons, perhaps, have rebelled against her. Hayula le'oyivim. She's been given over to her enemies. And there we're really quite deep. The image of the city is disappearing, and it's replaced by a woman. But in the next verse, we sort of back out. Galta Yehuda Meoni Merov Avoda. She has been exiled, and here Rashi and the others point out Meoni means due to. She has been exiled not because we're not talking about her sins; we're just talking about her situation. She has been exiled due to her suffering and because of all of the work that's been placed upon her. He Yashvav Agoyim Lo Matzah Manoah Korodfeh Hisigua Ben Hamitzarim. And there again, I think in between deep metaphor and light metaphor, where you could really see almost two images superimposed, both the city itself being exiled, as well as the woman herself really wandering among the nations. And the next verse, we float a little bit lighter. Darchei Tzion Avelot. So now we're talking about the streets of Zion, and there we're much more in the image of a city, not so much in the image of a woman. Now, if you've noticed, I've put two boxes around the text. One is third person, the other one is first person. And what you'll see is that the author, the poet, the Mekonein, the Yirmiyahu, is speaking about Sion, about this woman / city, referring to things that happened to her. In verse 7, for instance, verse Zion, Zachra Yushlaim Yimei Onya Umirudeha. And it's a slightly difficult pasuk, so let me help out with what Rabbi Ibn Kaspi points out, which is correct. Zachra Yushlaim Bimei Onya Umirudeha. Rashi has a different interpretation, but I think Rabbi Ibn Kaspi is more on the mark. Yushlaim remembers currently, in the days of her suffering and her downfall or her bitterness or her personal state of rebellion, or the word raid could be also her suffering, kol machamadeha, that is, she remembers now in her state of onya, everything, all of the beautiful things, asher hayumi mei kedem, that she had in the olden days, Bimpol Ama Biyad Sar, as her enemy, as her nation fell in the hands of the enemy. Ve'ein Ozer La Ra'uat Sarim, she now sees her, that is, she is trying to remember all of the good things, and yet in front of her eyes, she sees the enemy who are playing with her, Sachaku Al Kol Mishpatea, and they're playing with all of her cessations, with all of her stoppages. Rashi has an interesting interpretation. Perhaps it's that the Korbanot had to stop. Perhaps it's that they made fun of her because she kept Shabbat in exile. But the bottom line is, we're talking about the woman. The author is talking in third person about this woman, and does so for exactly half of the alphabet. If we go down to verse 11, I'll read the first half, which is cheating a little bit, but you'll see what I mean. Kol aman ne'enachim, all of her nation is sighing. Mevakshim lechem, they're searching for bread, which means they're starving, there's no food. Natnu machamedehem ba'ochel, they give away all of their jewelry, all of their precious things for just a little bit of food. Lashiv nafesh, in order to simply live. In the second section, however, we switch from third person to first person, which is that lo aleichem kol ovrei derech, I'm reading verse 12, or the Lamed verse, that is, this should not happen to you, anyone who is crossing by in the road. Habitu uru, look at me, essentially. Im yesh machov kemachovi, has anybody suffered as much as I'm suffering? Asher olel li, which they've plotted against me. Asher hoga adonai biyom charon abo, which God has caused me, the word hoga is the hifil of the word yagon, he has caused me to suffer in the day of his anger. Mimarom shalach esh ba'atzmotai v'yirdena, there's that word raid again, from the heavens, as I know God is doing this, he's sending fire down into my bones, and I am going down, I'm suffering. Paras reshet l'raglai, he has laid out a trap for my feet. Heshivani achori, has laid me back. Netanani shomim akol hayom davai. So if you see, what we have is, for the first half of the chapter, there is almost an abstraction, really, of the prophet, of the lamenter, speaking about something. But then he becomes, he puts himself into the character, if you will, and allows Yerushalayim to speak for herself. And I'd like to point out something right now. I don't know if you see that. Does everybody see the three boxes that showed up in verse 9, 10, and 11 in the Tet, Yud, and Chaf verse? Does everybody see what's wrong about that, quote-unquote, wrong about that text? I'll read the words. Re'ei Adonai et onyi. Actually, let me read the whole verse 9. Tumata bishuleha. Her uncleanliness, her impurity can be seen in her cloak, in her skirt. Lo zachra charita, she did not remember what would happen to her, i.e., when she sinned, she didn't realize what would become of her. Vatered plaim, she's gone down miraculously, which means she's gone down, you know, further than anybody could imagine. Ein menachem la, there is no one giving her comfort. Re'e Adonai et onyi, look God at my suffering, ki deal oyev, because the enemy has risen up against me. Does anybody see the problem poetically with that verse?
Yes, it goes back to first person.
Exactly right. I wouldn't exactly say it goes back to first person, because this is the first time we're seeing first person. It's as if, in my opinion, it's as if he's speaking about her in third person, and she is busting to get out. Do you see what I'm saying there? And the same thing happens in verse 11. Let's read verse 11. Kol amane nachim, all of her nation is sighing, mevakshim lechem, they're looking for bread. Natnu macham dehem beochel hashiv nefesh. Re'ei Adonai v'habita, look at me, God. Ki hayiti zolela, because I was worthless. From the word zol, probably. I was as if I was nothing. So here again, right before, and now the woman really busts through our sorrowful Tzion. Our city, who is suffering, is busting through to the point where in the next pasuk she takes over the microphone. It's as if she's sitting there on the stage while the lamenter talks about her, and she gets up in verse 9 to speak, and she gets up in verse 11, and she grabs away the microphone and says, I need to speak. But what's interesting is, in verse 12 to verse 22, she's sort of speaking in general to those who can see her. But who is she speaking to when she grabs the microphone away in verse 9 and verse 11? Any guesses?
She's speaking to God.
Yeah. She's speaking to who? To God. And she says it emphatically. In fact, she repeats the words. These words are repeated. In fact, I would have to say they're one of the common words that goes throughout the Eicha. Re'ei v'habita. Look at me, look at me. And this, of course, is the idea of Hester Panim, where this is not, as I mentioned before, this is not an Eov approach. An Eov approach is, I don't know why people suffer, God is beyond any of us, who are we to question why God does the thing he does, there's a plan, we have to trust in it. Here, we're suffering, A, because of our sins, but not so much because of our sins, but because God is turned away. And that Hester Panim is causing bad things to happen to us because when you take away the fence, and when you take away the levee, or when the levee breaks, to quote a great rock and roll band, mama, you gotta move. And if you take a look in Tehillim Pei, which we don't have right in front of us right now, and you can look on your own, that Tehillim is all about how God hides his face, and if he'd only put his face back, everything would be okay. And of course, that's the theme of the famous Mashal HaKerem of Yishayahu, which is that God has knocked down the fence, v'hayal v'air, and any animal could come, v'yaleh shamir v'shayit, and he has decided to no longer pay attention to his vineyard, and therefore it's not so much that God is punishing the vineyard, he doesn't have to. By the fact that God takes away his protection, the inevitable takes place. I would like to point out one more thing on this page, which is something I call intensification. If you've noticed, every time we have a simile, in verse 1, for instance, Echa yashva badad, ha'ira bat yam hayita ke'almana, she was like a widow. What follows that in the next verse is, b'chot tivkeh balayla, she cries in the night, v'dimata lechaya imam alachem mikol ha'ove'a, korea ba'agduva hayula lo'ivim. We have an intensification. We are fully immersed in the woman image. The same thing happens in verse 8. Chet chata yushalayim. See, up to this point, we've been in light immersion, where we could see the city and the woman at the same time, but really more the city than the woman. But what we say is, Alkein l'nida hayata. Do you see that same phrase that we had before? She's not just like an almana, it's worse than that. She's like a nida. Now Rashi and Ibn Ezra all say the right thing, which is that the word l'nida means she's pushed aside. It's like the word lanud rosh, that somebody shakes their head when they see Jerusalem. And it's a phrase from the word navinad, nodeid, ba'aret. But without question, there's no doubt that there's also, remember how I mentioned that in poetry, a word can be used equivocally. The poet's going to use a word for multiple meanings. And here, we're talking about a woman who has become defiled, who's become tamei. Kol mechabdeh hizilua kira'u ervata. Now, of course, erva could be simply translated just as secret places. However, we're talking about the image here. The woman is, this woman has been pushed to the ground. We have, to my mind, lost the image of the city. And we have this woman who is being attacked by her enemies in the worst sense that we could imagine. Vatasha Bachor, and she's leaning backwards. This also shows up in Yishayahu in chapter 4 about the woman who was pushed down to the ground. Tumata b'shuleha, her defilement is in her, can be seen in her cloak. Yud is yado paras sar al kol machamadeha. Her enemy has spread his hand. That's what it means. Yado paras sar. Sar is the subject of the sentence. Al kol machamadeha, on everything that she has. He's ripped off her jewelry. He's taken everything he has. And of course, ki ra'ata goyim ba'u mikdasha. I hate to say it, but of course, we have to flip back between the two images. On one hand, we're talking about the Beit HaMikdash. But on the other hand, we're talking about this woman who is really being given over to the enemy in the worst possible way. And Rashi and Chazal notice that, because the next words are Asher tzivita lo yavo b'kalach, that God has commanded your enemy has come into your mikdash in ways that God promised he never would. Now, in some sense, I'll show you a pasuk in Yeshayahu where God promises that, and that's probably what the author is referring to. But does anybody know what Chazal say this is referring to? Which promise did God say that these people should never come into your kahal? So Rashi says, Ammon and Moab. Ammon and Moab can never come into the kahal. So again, we have a sense of marriage or of union. And this is a terrible, terrible image that essentially, at the very end, the poet is intensified. So we could see this woman lying on the ground in an unspeakable manner. And then finally, she can't stand it anymore, and she pulls away the microphone from Yirmiyahu, and she demands to speak herself. Are there any other questions on chapter one about some of the things that I was referring to? I'm looking at the.
I was wondering if you had explained the significance of the atbash. You showed that they do it, but what's the meaning behind it?
Again, I'd have to be speculative. You know, you could ask the same question about what's the meaning of the acrostic. The rabbis believed in Gemara Brachot that an acrostic created a powerful, powerful message that went out to the people, that somehow it had a power by sticking to the holy Hebrew language. It could be that the idea of a chiastic structure is well known in Judaism, the fact that everything at the beginning matches at the end. So in one sense, it's a form of poetry. Chazal point out it was a way of memorizing things, that not only Aleph Bet, but the very fact that I could use tricks to remember the format would allow the people to remember this Kinah even they went into exile. I would have to say that, just from a literary standpoint, it creates a certain solidity. It creates a certain power that not only is the alphabet running in one way, it's running every which way at the same time. Again, that's purely speculation. We'll have to, God willing, in the time of Mashiach, we'll have to ask Yirmiyahu exactly what he was up to. Perhaps it just made it more powerful because he showed how much effort he put into it. But again, this is speculation. I can only speculate. Any other questions about the chapter one or the idea of the imagery and the woman who is being thrown to the ground? And then who grabs the microphone to speak about herself? Okay.
Is it possible that it's not her that's speaking, but it's Yirmiyahu that's speaking?
Oh, well, I'm going to try to... Hold on a second. I want to try to get my camera back. Rabbi Kelman pointed out that my face is not showing up. I think it's back. Yirmiyahu, of course, is speaking, but he's allowing, you know, again, in poetry, who is the speaker? I think Yirmiyahu is allowing the woman to speak for herself, and I think what we'll do is we'll go back to that page in a second, and I'll show you that it's the real cry of a woman in dire straits. So sure, Yirmiyahu is speaking, but I think the word is projecting. He's projecting Yerushalayim through his power, and since he's an inspired poet, that is, I'm not sure we would call this prophecy. We might call this like Ruach HaKodesh on the level of Tehillim. But either it's prophecy or it's inspired poetry. But that inspiration, that Ruach HaKodesh, is allowing him to channel the pain of Yerushalayim. And again, you could take this to a Kabbalistic level, as if Yerushalayim is literally speaking through him, or you could say this is the poet who's able to really capture her needs. But either way, I think the effect is there.
What I meant is maybe he's speaking about his own pain and having to see all this.
Oh, well, I think you're right, but he makes it powerful. Actually, I'm going to step away from that because what we'll see is in chapter 2, he speaks for himself. And we'll see the difference then between chapter 1 and chapter 2. So let me switch over. Now's a good time. Okay, I'm going to switch over now to chapter 2. Hopefully it'll show up on your screens. There we go. In chapter 2, I think I'll jump a little. We're running a little bit behind, so I'll jump a little bit to get to the point. Here, Yirmiyahu is speaking for himself about Yerushalayim. And we still have the metaphor of the woman, but it's a little bit lighter. If you take a look at the beginning, Yirmiyahu is not so much talking about a woman, he's talking about all of the places in Jerusalem and in Israel that can be destroyed. Echa Ya'iv Ba'po at Bat Zion. So there we have the woman. She's up in front and center. That is, Hishlich M'Shamayim Eretz Tiferet Yisrael, the glory of Israel. So what we have, and I'll try to highlight this with a pen, is Yirmiyahu is taking us on like a tour of all the ways that one could describe Israel. So one gets a sense of all of her aspects and all of her locations. So we have Bat Zion, we have Tiferet Yisrael, and he didn't remember Hadom Raglav. Now that's her, not her, that's the Beit HaMikdash, but it's described as the place where God settles his feet. Vila Dunai and Pasuk Bez, Velo Chamala, Kol Naot Yaakov. Naot are Binaot Deshe, Yarbitzini, all the pleasant places of Jacob. Haras Berato, Mitzrei Bat Yehuda, the towers, the fortifications of the daughter of Yehuda. Higia La'aretz. In Pasuk Gimel, we have Keren Yisrael, which is similar to Mashal HaKerem, but I won't go into that right now. Mashal HaKerem starts Kerem Hayali Didi be Keren Ben Shemen. And we have Vayivar be Yaakov Ke'esh Lahava, so we have the generic term Yaakov. Ba'ohel Bat Sion in verse Dalid. Shafach Ke'esh Chamato, his anger came down like fire. Kol Armanotel and Pasuk Hey, Shichet Mivtzarav, he destroyed the battlements. Vayerev Bivat Yehuda Ta'aniyah Va'aniyah. Yerev is the Hifyel, he caused to be increased in Bat Yehuda Ta'aniyah, suffering, pain, and suffering. And then we continue on. Vayachamos, he destroyed Kagan like a garden. I assume a garden that you pluck things out of. Sukkot, his Sukkot, which means his Beit HaMikdash. Shichet Moado, his Oel Moed. And then in the next pasuk, Zanach Mizbacho, the altar was left barren or destroyed. Ni'er Mikdasho, he destroyed his holy places. His Gir Biadovev, Chomat Armanotel, the walls of its embattlements. Bivet Hashem. And the next pasuk, Chashav Hashem Lashchi Chomat Bat Zion, Vayavel Chel V'Chomad. The inner walls and the outer walls were all destroyed. Yachdav Umlanlu, they were all brought down. So really, we've almost lost the metaphor here. And Yirmiyahu has taken us on a walking path, like a walking tour. L'Havdil Elef Alafim, for everybody who's been on a walking tour of Jerusalem, it's an inspiring experience. But had we been there with Yirmiyahu during the destruction, he's taking us around to everywhere in Yerushalayim and showing us how everything was destroyed, but moreover, everything was destroyed by God himself. Not by the enemies, but by God himself. So here, Yisrael, is where I would say that the prophet is talking about Jerusalem, but we can hear his own voice. And now he continues on and says, Tavu ba'aret sha'areha. So now with the word sha'areha, we get back to her. The woman starts to show up because it's not its gates, but her gates. Ibad b'shibar b'richeha. It's a b'riach is a hinge. Are destroyed. Sareha b'goyim. Her officers are among the nations. Nevi'eha, her prophets, lo matzu chazon miyatzar. Yashvu la'aretz yidmuzik nei ba'atzion, helu lefar al-rosham, etc., etc. Now, if you notice what happens, though, is at the very end of the chapter, in Pasuk Reish Shin and Tav, that is Chav Chafal and Chafbet, she gets to speak for herself again. Re'e Adonai v'habita. Do you remember those words? Again, this is what she always calls out for. Look, God, at me. Lemi olal tako. Who did you plot against? Or that is really not so much against whom, because obviously we know it's against him. It's Jerusalem. It's more Lama Olal Tako. In Tochana Nashim Piryam Olet Pachim. Look, women are eating their very children. Can it be possible? The word im is lest, or can it be possible that women would eat their own children? In Yehareg Mikdash Adonai Kohen and the Navi. Does God really want to destroy in very Beit Hamikdash a Kohen and a Navi? Shachfu Laaretz Chutzot Narm Zakim Betulotai Bacharai Naflu Bacharev. People are being killed here. Haragta Biyom Apecha Tavachta Lo Chamalta. You've had any mercy. But what's very interesting, and I'm going to take a second just to hear your voices, is in the very beginning we had what we had in the previous chapter where Yirmiyahu was talking about her. At the very end, she's so upset that she's talking about herself and how miserable she and what she sees. She sees the children in herself being destroyed. But in the middle section, the question is, who's talking and to whom are they talking? I'll read the pasuk and then I'll ask for a suggestion. Ma aideh, what can I swear about you? Ma adam elach, what can I compare you to? Habat Yerushalayim, O daughter of Jerusalem. Ma ashvelach v'anachamech b'tzulat patzion. In what way could I compare you to something and then be comforted? Ki gadol kayam shivrech mi yirpalach. Your destruction is so great. Your breakage is like the ocean in its depth. Mi yirpalach, who could possibly heal you? So I ask a question to you all. Who is speaking to whom? And what's the point that's being made? Anybody? Shalom, am I still coming through okay? Hello?
Coming through loud and clear.
Oh, okay. Anybody have a suggestion on who was speaking to whom?
Oh, Yisrael talking to Yerushalayim?
Well, on the receiver, I agree with you 100%. It's definitely Yerushalayim. The speaker could be Klal Yisrael, but it could be the lamenter himself. It could be Yirmiyahu saying, listen, I'm supposed to tell everybody how things are going to be okay. I'll tell you a story about what happened to Hebron or what happened to Egypt or what happened to something. And it was really bad for 7 years or for 70 years and then things got better. But what he's saying is I have no comparison. This is unique in the history of my experience. I can't come up with a metaphor that will make you feel better. Because what I see is a destruction that's so great that it seems to me that it will never, ever be healed. And it sounds to me like Yirmiyahu almost at the length. Now, it could be us. You're right. It could be Klal Yisrael. But I think that this is the lamenter speaking to us. We're speaking, that is, he's putting on a play, if you will. She's sitting there again. You remember how I mentioned that it's like she's sitting there and he's speaking to us about her. In the first chapter, she grabs the microphone away and she wants to speak about her own sorrow. But here he turns to her and says, I'm at a loss here. And he describes something which is so terrible that she can't hold herself back. And let me show you what that terrible thing is that he starts to describe that causes her to speak out for herself. In Pasuk Yud Tet, right before she talks for herself, that's the transition Pasuk. So let's read it and see if we get a sense of it. Kumi, Roni Balaila. So he's doing something a little different here. He is, up to this point, he's been speaking to her about things that are happening to her. Let me give you an example. In Pasuk Tet Vav, the Samach Pasuk, he says, Safku Alayach Kapayim. Kol Ovrei Derech. Everybody who sees you is smacking their hands in wonder. Sharku, they're screaming. Ve'anu Rosham, they're shaking their heads. Alba Yushalayim, Hazota Ir, and they're saying, is this the city Sheomru Klilat Yofi was completely beautiful in the Soskol Aretz, the joy of all the world? In Pasuk Yud Zayin, he's also talking to her, but he's describing what he sees. Asa Adonai Asher Zaman, God did what he said he was going to do. Bitsa imrato asher tzivan mekadem. He did what he said he was going to. He performed what he said he would when he promised you'd be mekadem. Apparently, when he promised that if they didn't do tshuva, they would be destroyed. Haratz v'lo chamal. He's destroyed with no mercy. Vayisamach alayich oyev herim keren sarayich. And the enemies have lifted their masts above you. But in Pasuk Yud Tet, he's not talking. In Pasuk Yud Chet and Yud Tet, he's not describing something. Does everybody see the verbs there? In the middle of Yud Chet, he says, Horidi kanachal dima. And in Pasuk Yud Tet, he's saying, Kumi roni balayla. He's not talking to her about things that are happening there. What are those verbal forms? What is he doing to her there? Any suggestions? So I'll go on for the sake of time. He's commanding her. He's saying, get up and yell. Haridi kanachal dima, start to pray for yourself. Yomam v'layla, not just dima at night, like we start off in chapter 1. You got to wake up and scream day and night. Alti nipugat lach. Don't give silence or stoppage to yourself. Alti don batanech. What are you being silent for? Kumi roni v'layla, scream in the middle of the night. L'rosh ha-shmarot. When the guards, as soon as the guards get switched, and I'm probably talking about God's guards as well. Shechi kamayim libech, that's a command. Let your heart flow out like water. Pnei Adonai, see, nochach pnei Adonai, in front of God, see alayach kapayim, raise up your hands, ol nefesh ol alayach, because of your children. Notice the play on the word ol alayach, plotting, but here we have olayach, children, ha'atufim that are fainting, we have the word lehit aleif, but that's what this means here, ha'atufim barav barosh kol chutzot. Look at your children that are passing out from starvation. The starvation is the first, most obvious and most gruesome thing that happens during a siege. And she's saying, the prophet is saying to her, as if she could still talk to herself, for herself, and that may explain that Yirmiyahu was writing this at least partially during that time, wake up, stop your silence, stop crying in the middle of the night where nobody could hear you, wake up and do something. And then she listens to him, and she says, Rei Adonai Vabita Lani Olalta, do you see the word on the play, Olalta? To plot with olalayach, your children, im tochala nashim piryam olay tipuchim. Must it come to the fact that mothers will eat their children out of starvation? Im yareg b'mikdash Adonai koim navi shachvu ba'aretz chutzot nar v'zakein. The old and the young are laid out in the open spaces in the courtyards. Bacharai naflu b'cherev harak tavi amatecha tavachta lo chamal tikrak yomo ein megurai misaviv. This is not a pray against the enemies. This is, again, an accusation against God. Tikra ki yom mo'ed. Rather than a yom mo'ed in the Beit HaMikdash, you called all of the enemies together, misaviv. V'lo haya b'yom af Adonai palit v'sarid, and nobody managed to get away. Asher tipachta v'ribiti, from the littlest, the word tipuchim, v'ribiti, and from the greatest, oyvi chilam, my enemies have destroyed them all. So she calls out like Yirmiyahu told her to, but it is a great sorrow that she does with it. There's a nice pasuk from that just showed up in your screen. Perhaps you see it from Tehillim Mem Bet, but I'll continue on. Now in verse 4, and we only have, I think, 2 minutes, so I'll just point out that the imagery in chapter 4 disappears. There's no more woman here whatsoever. There is description of the death and destruction, with the main part being, I mean, the truth is, this is so horrible that I have a hard time reading it, and I apologize, but I guess it is what it is. Davak lashon yonekel chikop batsama. There was so starvation. Olim shalu lechem pores ein laem. There wasn't a single bread for anybody. Zakut. Their skin turned white, admu etzem mipninim, and their bones blackened or reddened. Chashach mishchor ta'oram, they darkened into blackness. Yidei nashim rachmaniot bishlu yaldehem, they boiled their children. Hayu levar olam ar b'sheber barami. And of course, this is very Holocaust oriented, where you know the starvation is so terrible. Here's a terrible pasuk in pasuk Dalet, which is. Let me see if I could find it. It's a pasuk which says, "Tovim hay tovim." Oh, here it is. Pasuk Tet. Tovim hayu chale cherev michale ra'av shehem yazuvu medikarim mitznuvat sadai. And Rashi's student Rav Yosef Kara points out that if we only had the first pasuk, it would mean that it was better for those to get slaughtered by the sword, tovim hayu chale cherev michale ra'av, than to die by starvation because it's slow. But that's not what the rest of the pasuk says. Shehen yazuvum dukarim, because they die or they melt or they drip as if they were stabbed, mitnuvot sadai, when they eat the fruit of the field. And this is truly a Holocaust image. We all know the stories about the people that were starving to death, and when the soldiers came, they gave them their sea rations, but they couldn't handle it. That is, when they ate real food, the food itself, in the worst of irony, the food that was supposed to save these starving, wretched people, wound up, our starving, wretched people, wound up destroying them. And that's what that pasuk means. That even somebody wound up to get their hands on a stolen piece of food, it would wind up killing them. So in Pasuk Daled, we've left the imagery. The woman is no longer able to speak. She said what she said. And now the prophet describes exactly what it is that that he saw. Pasuk, hey, again, we pretty much went over time, and we have another week to go next week. So we'll get into some issues. One of the most important issues that I'd like to talk about, and I'll end with this, is something called the timeline, just to give an introduction to next week's shiur. Now that we kind of have a flow of the book itself, we'll start to see that actually the book takes place in four phases, and that each chapter, 1, 2, 4, and 5, are describing a different year of the destruction, and that's essentially what we'll go through. I'm sorry, I went a little bit over time, I think. I don't know if there are any time for questions, so I'd be happy to take any. Let me switch back to full screen mode. And if anybody has any questions, or anybody wants to type anything in, I see Alan Bernstein wrote that. Thank you very much. I couldn't see the clock while I was in the full screen mode. Anybody have any final questions?
Are we to take all the imagery here literally, such as the boiling of the children and so forth?
Yes, because in chapter four, the images, the metaphors are gone completely. And in fact, it's for the very reason I think you're pointing out, which is now that the metaphors have been stripped away and we're walking through literally what's going on in Jerusalem, that means that I think what we're meant to read is literally happening. Now, there are some similes there. In the verse 2, it says that even animals are more merciful to their children, but your children have no room for mercy. They get no mercy whatsoever. So there are some metaphors. But I think for the fact that the metaphoric language of verse 1 and verse 2 that so immersed us was stripped away, that shows the raw exposure. Now, we have a lot of similes. We have metaphors like your skin was as dark and as hard or rotten as a tree bark. But that's a localized metaphor. That's to enhance the reality of the image, not to say that the image didn't actually take place. And, of course, it's difficult for us to imagine. Who in the year 2000 could imagine such starvation? There's a famous story about Ahav walking on, or somebody walking on the walls, and there's, I don't know, in Sefer Malachim, about how these two women have an argument about which child to eat first. It's in chapter 13, I think, of 2 Kings. And we can't imagine such a thing, thank God. I have to say, on a personal note, that when I'm in Yerushalayim for Tisha B'Av, it's very difficult. Yerushalayim is beautiful. Even the Kotel, which is a sign of destruction. Everything in Jerusalem is beautiful. The children and the old people playing in the streets. I once, when I was a kid, I walked through the streets of Jerusalem at 3 o'clock in the morning because there was no other way for me to appreciate what Yirmiyahu was talking about. And even that was a pale comparison. Somebody's pointing out, let me read what somebody... Yeah, I'm sorry. I see somebody is writing in. Susan Franklin Parker is writing in that I didn't see the questions when people were asking them. I apologize if I missed some. The foxes running all around the Jerusalem walls, you know, I think that's a real image. And the fact that it's so hard for us to see these images, I can only say thank God, because I can't imagine what it would be like to be starving so much. You know what it's like, and I'll describe it a little next week, because Yirmiyahu would discuss it himself. People lose their humanity, and I hate to bring in an image of the World Trade Center, but when people were jumping from windows, you'd have to say to yourself, why were they jumping from windows? Didn't they know they'd die? But I think at a certain point, a human being is driven past the point where he's human, and his decisions or her decisions are no longer understandable. And I'll show you that in chapter 4, where even animals were making real decisions, but the humans, we humans, in the state of siege and death and destruction, to the point where even if you could find an apple to eat, it would kill you, caused people to behave in inhuman ways. And we can only pray that it never happens again. That's pretty much all I have for today. What I'll do is I'll review some of this screen if I can and try to see if there were any questions I didn't answer, and maybe do that next week as well. Rabbi Kelman, is that it? Do I just sign off? Shalom, do I simply sign off?
Just say good night, folks.
Good night, Gracie.